Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that is currently accepting regifted Halloween edibles, particularly in Manhattan, from what I understand. I'm Matt Welsh, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy November, gang.
Howdy Halloween.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Because Catherine's our boss, and she's a cruel dictatrix. She suggested that we talk about our Halloween costumes, and I just want to register my absolute jealousy or appalledness that apparently the entire Reason DC office dressed up as Loki, including an alligator.
Yeah. So we were technically not all Loki. We were all Marvel characters, but perhaps predictably, many Reason staffers gravitated toward the trickster god and morally gray protagonist Loki. I was Sylvie, the lady Loki from the spinoff series, and I gotta say my costume was amazing, though not quite as amazing as Suderman's. He was President Loki, also from the Loki spinoff series.
The fifth episode.
He did bring the alligator. So
what? Oh yeah. President Loki? Which one was President?
He's the one who is wearing the green suit and the little button that says vote for Loki. He's also the leader of
the
bad faction of Lokis. So, I mean, I feel like that's actually fitting, right? this is the correct
Let's go,
view
Loki.
Is that, like, on the one hand, Loki is usually bad, but President Loki is even worse.
Correct. But yeah, the Reason office acquitted itself admirably here in D.C. I do believe that if Reason is to have a holiday, it is Halloween. And so this was basically our equivalent of the dubious office Christmas party, and it delivered.
Nick, did you participate in the Halloween parade?
No, I did not.
Someone did come dressed as Nick to our party, which was basically just a bad wig and frankly indistinguishable from the original.
Yeah, he looked a little trimmer than me too. Good old Scott Ewine, super fan, wonderful super human being. Progenitor of the next generation of great Americans. But yeah, that was kind of frightening.
I went to a costume party, of which there will be more discussion because it's very important to later on in the episode. But I was basically trying to dress up as Cat Timpf's dad. So
really?
I just tried to get old man clothes. Much more than actual Cat Timpf's dad, who's a really sweet guy and another super fan of Reason and a swell person. But I was just a generic dad was the look I was going for. And so I had a scramble for about 2 minutes at a used furniture shop around the corner that has some clothes in the back and got me a cardigan and this houndstooth Ty Cobb hat that I'm wearing. And I think it's become my new old man thing.
You just went straight from bandana to houndstooth, huh? Like, well, we're not going to stop in the middle?
No, okay. No. I think this is the natural progression of things. All right, enough banter, Catherine. We're going to talk about the latest developments in the Build Back Better bill here in a moment. But first, do you value the privacy of your own data? If so, please allow me to introduce yourself to Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in the great country of Switzerland. Using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in the land of milk, chocolate, and financial privacy, Secure protects your data from various intrusive governments and laws. It features 100% homegrown technology, zero affiliation with big tech giants like Amazon, Google, Microsoft. Make your move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That's SEKUR.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. On Thursday, we got new details from a slumping President Joe Biden about the big reconciliation must-pass bill and what that will look like. It's now has a price tag, which should be understood as fictitious, at $1.85 trillion. Over 10 years, that includes $555 billion for climate change mitigation, $400 billion for childcare, and so forth. I think the headline quote from our own Eric Boehm was, The bill promises to do everything but still costs nothing, which is always an interesting and winning combo. The president hailed this as a breakthrough negotiation agreement before jetting off overseas to talk about Satchel Paige with the Pope. True fact, that happened. But then the House of Representatives tabled voting on the infrastructure bill. That might happen as soon as Tuesday, according to reporting here on late Monday morning when we tape these podcasts on the East Coast time. Biden claims, and I quote, that the package will create millions of jobs, grow the economy, invest in our nation and our people, turn the climate crisis into an opportunity, and put us on a path not only to compete, but to win the economic competition for the 21st century against China and every other major country in the world. End exhausted sounding quote that could have been cut and pasted from any Obama speech in 2009. We keep talking on this podcast about what the hell is actually in this thing, because basically this is Joe Biden's entire first-term domestic agenda in two gargantuan-sized bills. So, Peter, can you get us started with a talk about any particularly salty content here in this bill?
Oh, yeah, salt, as in the state and local tax deduction, right? Yeah, it's what you're supposed to put on your steak, along with pepper and nothing else. So the salt deduction is a priority for blue state liberals for a reason, because what the SALT deduction is currently, the way that it's currently set up is that you can deduct, there's about $10,000 worth of state and local taxes on your tax returns, on your federal tax returns. And so the goal here, or what liberals want, is to lift that cap entirely, or perhaps to raise it. And so it's not entirely clear, because I will say, in the outline released by President Biden last week, the SALT cap repeal wasn't in the actual package. But there's tons of reporting that says that it is, and the folks from New Jersey and New York and California are saying, well, look, this is a big item for us. This is a priority. And, you know, so in some ways it's a tax cut, and I always have to address this for a reason, folks, right? So it's, hey, you pay less in taxes. But what it actually is, it's a subsidy. And in particular, it's a subsidy for high state taxes, right? Because what it does is it says that if your state taxes are very high, then you have to pay less in federal taxes. And so, of course, that offsets the cost of living in a very high tax state like New York or New Jersey or California. And so what's interesting about this is that if they end up lifting the SALT cap entirely, which, again, is not something we know for certain, because even though there is supposedly a package here, it's still in flux. There's no actual agreement. There's a deal, but there's no real deal. But if it ends up in the final package, as many people are expecting it to, then it will end up being a net tax cut for the well-off, at least for the first couple of years. And that's kind of ironic, given that one of the big promises that President Biden has made here is that, oh, we're going to pay for all of this by raising taxes on the rich. And so what it turns out is the Democrats actually have to do constituent service for their wealthy for wealthy Democratic voters in blue states. And it looks like this is going to end up in the bill. And it's also, you know, it's also expensive, right? This if you presume that just in terms of mathematical terms, right, like this sort of tax cut costs the government, right, because there's less revenue. This is about $180 billion over the course of a decade or so. And what that means is that this is about 10% of the cost of the bill. And so Democrats are going to spend about $180 billion in order to provide a very large tax cut to mostly blue state liberals who are pretty well off, is what it looks like.
That's just amazing. Catherine, I know you enjoyed the first Biden quote, so let's give you a second Biden quote.
I'm still mad about the first one. I don't know if I can take a second one.
He calls it the most significant investment to deal with a climate crisis that has ever, ever happened to Evers beyond any other advanced nation in the world. So is he right or is he totally right?
Yeah, I was already mad about the fact that there's $105 billion to be spent on resilience investments to mitigate the effects of extreme weather and legacy of pollution in this bill. That the fact that the whole darn thing is just a quote unquote investment, as we talked about in a previous podcast, I don't think it means what you think it means. That is not the right way to use that word. It's spending. And yeah, I think, you know, the previous quote about how we're going to win the economic competition with the rest of the world, again, just horrifically misbegotten and wrongheaded. We are not trying to win. We are trying to cooperate. And I am sorry that we have this like primitive mindset in which we are trying to win. That is wrong. So yeah, Biden went off to the climate change conference in Scotland. I sure bet he wanted to show up at that conference with this bill done. I am guessing that this is tough times for Biden because he was hoping to...
You don't have to bet. He's said that.
Yeah. So he was hoping to roll in. He was hoping to roll in and be like, look, at all this like insane amount of money that we're spending on environmental stuff, you guys are a bunch of laggards, get it together. And instead he had to come in and be like, I promise we're going to... Just as soon as I get back, we're going to finish this probably maybe even tomorrow. Well, I'll let you know. The environmental stuff in the bill is a lot. It's a huge part of the bill. $320 billion in tax credits for clean energy and associated technologies. $110 billion to goose the market for solar panels, batteries, stuff like that. You know, this is... You know, this is some of the less controversial stuff in this bill, some of this spending, which tells you how very, very controversial the bill is, because this is not something that people broadly agree the government should be spending money on. And as Christian Bridgekey notes in his roundup this morning, he is filling in for Liz Nolan Brown, who is on maternity leave and doing a great job. He also notes, by the way, there's $20 billion in this bill for national flood insurance, which is basically a subsidy for rich people to live on the coasts and build their houses back over and over, including in a great, I think, cover story feature for a reason, John Stossel, who described himself as a welfare queen because he is a beneficiary of this program. So, you know, the sea levels are rising, etc. But don't worry, you can keep building your house on the coast.
They don't call it build back better for nothing. Yes.
I like how Biden, you know, had said we want to get this bill done before we end up at the climate conference. And of course they didn't. And so this morning the White House released a statement that Biden's gonna go there and he's gonna make a personal commitment to fighting climate change.
That and a nickel will get you a cup of coffee.
Where do you get a
Nick,
cup of coffee for a nickel?
When, yeah,
wherever Matt's when hat Matt's least hat, came from.
When hat's, Matt's hat was made, yes.
I love this hat. Nick, but at least they're thinking of the children, right?
Yeah. What I find particularly annoying in the bill is there's going to be a lot of, for child care and universal pre-K. We've talked about universal preschool a bit in the past, but the child care provisions are extremely popular. According to polling, something like 80% of people who care about this bill love the child care provisions, which would, among other things, work to double the salaries of more than double the salaries of daycare workers. The goal in the it behind these provisions in the bill is to make them have the same costs, or rather the same salaries as elementary school teachers. And the typical daycare worker is making somewhere around $25,000, $30,000. The typical elementary school teacher is making around $60,000. So that's a massive increase. It would also have provisions that if it gets implemented the way that it's been discussed, after 3 years, it would cap daycare expenses as a percentage of your income. The highest level that would be paying would be people, kids with households of more than that make more than $150,000. That would be capped, rather 150% of median state income. That would be capped at 7%, which would mean in a family that is making currently 150% of the median household income, they wouldn't pay more than $6,100 a year for daycare, as opposed to that's about half of what the general cost is for full-time daycare currently. And as a result, this is going to massively increase costs or rather increased demand for daycare without actually giving a means of increasing supply. None of this stuff, and this is a kind of classic example, something was going on similar with Obamacare, where the idea is to make everything cheaper and to pay everybody involved more money, but we're not going to increase supply. And it's just, it's kind of amazing because I've written about daycare scenarios now for over 25,000 years.
It feels like for us.
I'm also working on a Zager and Evans song that comes to it comes to the same conclusion. But historically and can even now, most people report amazing satisfaction with the daycare that they have. But there has been a 20-year push going back to the Clinton administration to say the only people who should be allowed to deliver daycare are college grads, are people with education backgrounds, with a lot of different certification and credentials that will drive up the cost and also squeeze the supply, even though among people, the 60% of families who have their kids in some form of daycare, whether it's a center, whether it's a relative, whether it's somebody's home, about 95% report, you know, that they're either satisfied or very satisfied with their daycare. So this is a persistent issue that always is lurking on the edge of things. And this time around, I think it has a good chance of getting put into place, one way or another. And it will be one of these things that is absolutely done for the children, but it's actually kind of soothing upper middle class anxiety about daycare. So that's where that's at.
Peter, Nick referenced polling. A new poll came out in the last couple of days saying that only 36% of people believe that the bill would be good for their families, while something like 33% or around one third believe that they would be hurt. Those are not usually good numbers for passing a bill. I've seen a lot of places that used to describe themselves as providing explanatory journalism do a whole lot of, I don't get it, man, because I mean, everything in the bill is popular. So why isn't the whole bill popular? It feels like people are stupider than 12 years ago when it comes to things like polling and trade-offs, or am I just getting cranky with my old man hat?
Well, I just think there's a pretty clear voter disgruntlement with the Biden administration and the economy right now, and part of the reason they are disgruntled with President Biden is because of the economy. There was a pretty good, I should say very good, Kristen Soltis Anderson column recently. Kristen Soltis Anderson is a Reason friend, a personal friend, and a pollster. And she sort of helps people think through what polls mean and sort of how to interpret them. She's always sort of been my guru and my go-to guide on this sort of thing. And she has written that, in fact, what we're seeing in the polling is not only that Biden is unpopular and people are unhappy with the economy, but that that voters are starting to specifically connect Democratic policies to the things they don't like about the economy, in particular to rising prices, to inflation, to that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think that Democrats need to be thinking about the economic environment that they're trying to do all of this in, which is causing shifts in the political environment. There was another poll, I believe, at least Nick flagged it in Slack, I think may have written about it recently, that, you know, just sort of said that voters are starting to turn away from big government after a couple of years of being more in favor of it, and that they're actually coming around to favoring a smaller and more limited government. Now, I think, you know, if you drill down on the particulars, that's always a little bit complicated because, in fact, people do like the big social spending programs, the big entitlements, Medicare and Social Security in particular, which is why the Republican Party has dropped even the pretense of wanting to reform or reduce spending on those programs. But it is notable that the public mood has soured on Biden-style big government, just as Democrats are prepared to pass one of the biggest, maybe the biggest social spending bill in a decade or more.
Catherine, speaking of public mood turning against Democratic governance, one of the stories that's taking up perhaps even more oxygen over the weekend in political journalism chatter is not even the $1.85 trillion whatever bill, but the governor's race in Virginia, where do you live there, or like you're familiar with it or something like that. The race is on Tuesday between longtime Clintonite Democratic hack and former governor of Virginia, since they only do one term there, Terry McAuliffe, who was sort of supposed to cakewalk against a relatively unknown finance bro and former Rice Owls bench warmer, Nick, on the basketball team there, Glenn Youngkin. I think we should make that three syllables.
I'm going to convene like a UN committee on name abuse and haul you before it.
I don't understand. Well, first of all, you're gonna have to walk me through how to pronounce,
let alone
spell,
but it wasn't that
Loudoun County. But anyways, this wasn't a close race until about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, when at a debate talking about education, which has been the biggest issue from Youngkin's point of view, Terry McAuliffe said something along the lines of, well, parents shouldn't have effects or shouldn't have a say in curriculum or the way the schools are managed. This became a pretty much of a Kinsley gaffe. Just go Google that one up. I think I pronounced it correctly. But anyway, since then, Youngkin has shot up in the polls. It's now being seen as a national referendum on school board policies and whatnot. Catherine, I would invite you, as a former Loudoun County native, to talk about it, but maybe as a framing device, react to this headline I saw just this morning from Juan Williams, writing in The Hill, and this was actually an accurate reflection of the content of his column, which is that parents' rights, in quotation marks, is code for white race politics. So is that what's going on in Virginia, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because every single person in Virginia seems to be saying the quiet part loud. Like, it's actually bizarre. It's like we just stopped pretending that we were going to do this, like, veneer of politics where normal sort of conventions were followed. And instead, everyone was just going to say out loud the thing that they were trying to quietly telegraph. And so I think that's where you get this sentiment, this idea that, like, literally everything is a dog whistle or a code word or whatever.
Which is McAuliffe's direct quote. It's a dog whistle on race.
Right.
What's happening.
And, you know, McAuliffe said, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. That was the quote that energized people. And I think, you know, as a product of Virginia schools and a person who is constantly being summoned by the forces of evil to move back to the Virginia suburbs, though probably not quite all the way to Loudoun County, you know, I think... Like, fuck that. Like, absolutely not. Like, that's an insane thing to say. Now, should parents have the final say on each individual teacher's classroom plan for the day? No, but that's just division of labor. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is, should parents have some transparency and some input on what is being taught in the classrooms? I listened this morning to this week's Dispatch podcast, just their kind of generic one, which had one of the Loudoun activist parents on, a sort of ringleader. And one thing that I was struck by is that the whole conversation about what this conversation about education is about is so slippery. It's like, is it about race? Is it about trans kids in the bathroom? Is it about CRT? Is CRT the same thing as DEI? No, it's a little different, but we're still mad about all of it. And anyway, it's really about school choice, but maybe it's not really about school choice. Is it about Jesus? I don't know. Like, thing. And then actually, is it all really, really, really about Trump? And I, of course, the other thing that happened at the end here of this race was, like, I hesitate to even describe this thing. I, you know, my husband is not extremely online. He is like a normie. And so I came home the other day and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe those Tiki Torch guys is next to the bus. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, okay. I forgot.
Explain it to the normies who are listening, because it's amazing.
I feel like I might get it wrong because it's so stupid, but I'm going to try.
I'll help you. Go on.
So some guys showed up at a Youngkin event. They were dressed like the guys from Charlottesville. They had on khakis and they were holding tiki torches. Khakis and white shirts. They were holding tiki torches. It was raining. So, like, and they were wearing sunglasses. They were wearing sunglasses. And one of them was black.
Yeah.
So just, like, setting the scene for you here. Men
posing in front of a bus. A young Youngkin
saying, yeah, we're all in for Youngkin. Now, this apparently didn't set off the satire meters immediately of all of the people who witnessed it. And so we had a brief moment where some mid-sized news personalities seemed to think that, yes, the Charlottesville guys had come out for Youngkin.
Mid-sized in terms of their audience, right?
Yes. Not in terms of their person. Then there was, of course, quickly a wave of debunking, like, you idiots, this is not. And then the Lincoln Project claimed credit, but we don't know. Did they do it the way, like, ISIS claims credit for terror attacks they didn't do? Or, like, so I don't know if we know definitively at this point, was it, in fact, a Lincoln Project joint? And if so, why? But anyway, that's the Tiki Torch guy's story.
But it's a pleasure to be talking about.
So just
let's do the next half hour on Let's Go, Brandon.
Right. Which we should probably talk about too. But I guess I just want to say, like, the Virginia race has slipped the bonds of actual...
The surly bonds of actual
policy discussion or really anything having to do with anything, yeah, in reality, and is now pure culture war signaling in every direction and will be until it is mercifully over.
Can I actually argue with that just a little bit?
Yeah.
That is what's happening on Twitter for sure. And that is what's happening in the last 72 hours of media coverage. I don't disagree with that at all. At the same time, Youngkin is rising in the polls because parents care about education. And that is an actual policy issue, even if real substantive reforms are not at the heart of what is being discussed. And parents care about education, and they're not, in many cases, in favor of the Democratic establishment's approach to education, which is basically screw the parents. We're only going to do what teachers' unions want to do. And frankly, we don't really care that much about the kids either. And again, this is a real substantive issue that underlies all of this, even if it's not like these guys are out there debating white papers about exactly how we should, about school curriculum policy.
So what is Youngkin's education policy?
In part, it's to allow for school choice, which they don't have. Mm-hmm. I mean, as J.D. Chichilli
wrote
this morning.
Is he against critical race? Is he banning critical race theory and or whatever that means?
He said something along those lines.
Yeah. So he's really in favor of school choice, right? Except for when you have a school that teaches an Afrocentric curriculum or actually deals with history. And I think, to me, from a libertarian point of view, this debate over education policy and the way that it is being framed, and I think this is the way that people on the right and the left want to play this. It's endlessly frustrating, and I think it's going to backfire on the school choice movement, which has been doing extremely well because of COVID. Because COVID, you know, if the Vietnam War, you know, brought war home to the living rooms of America, the fucking COVID lockdowns and pandemics brought education into the living rooms of Americans' households. And they're like, you've got to be kidding me. This is what we are paying for. In every state in the union, education is either the most expensive or the second most expensive in the state budget. It's what a majority of people's taxes go to pay for on the state and local level. And they realize it's a terrible, terrible product. They want school choice. And now, though, you have Republicans who, on the one hand, are kind of hand waving and saying, yeah, yeah, we want backpack funding. We want to get rid of school districts. We want to get rid of school boards and just have schools that either attract or fail to attract students based on, you know, a certain amount of funding that every kid gets. And so we want school choice as long as you're not teaching CRT. And that is going to alienate a lot of people in the school choice movement, particularly people who are minority or are interested in helping minorities. And I think, there's a guy like Chris Stewart, who's a great education, libertarian education, Black Christian activist in Minnesota, who is saying, you know what, this is turning school choice politics into, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, conservatives versus liberals, and that's going to kill the movement. And to me, that coming out of the Virginia race, I think, you know, the way that it's being framed on this is just disastrous, really, for school choice, because Youngkin and most Republicans are not interested in school choice. They want to use schools and education as a way to fuck over Democrats, but they don't actually want to disperse and decentralize and empower parents to get their kids' education on the terms that they want.
So not to sound like Terry McAuliffe, but, like, isn't this also largely about Trump. I mean, you know, I think all of us were like somewhat heartened to hear Trump say and get applause at the conventions and in other contexts, you know, that he favored school choice, that he thought parents should have school choice, that they should have a say in their children's education. But I know that I also worried that school choice brought into the culture war and implemented badly would be in the long run bad. And I think Virginia has sort of been the test case for that. And the reason that McAuliffe picked this fight in the first place, I think COVID was part of it, and the sort of increasing salience of school politics was part of it. But I also think it was another way for him to tie Youngkin to Trump, which was his campaign strategy.
Yeah, I the Virginia race is definitely of interest now because people are trying to cast it as a referendum on Trump and whether or not Trump can return from exile in 2024. But I think the larger question, because this is playing out in states like Florida and Texas that claim to be in, you know, where they have governors who have passed legislation or legislatures trying to pass legislation against certain words and concepts being taught in schools, even as they support school choice. So I think these are related but separate issues. And I think it's worth talking about the Virginia race, whether or not it is a proxy for Trump.
Well, I think there's a difference between the way schools are organized and the way people argue about curriculum. And this has been intentionally conflated by the likes of Christopher Rufo at the Manhattan Institute, who decided that critical race theory was a great way to brand that particular problem and get people excited about. And we've seen backlash bills in places like Texas and especially that are awful, that are just like, you know, Republican guys sitting around saying, OK, here's my list of 850 books that probably shouldn't be in schools. Like, thank you, anti-CRT movement. But actual school choice, the way schools are organized, can there be backpack funding? Do you allow for charter schools? Things like that is an organizational thing. And I think Glenn Youngkin has been in favor of that in a significant degree. And it would be, I think, inaccurate to present him as being anti-school choice because he says he doesn't like the way that critical race theory is being implemented. And
I don't know. I asked about that. If he's for passing legislation that would limit, what can be taught in Virginia schools, you know, based on CRT fears, I don't think he's in favor of school choice.
If he's in favor of having more than 8 charter schools, and he is, then I just think there's two different streams of school choice that we're talking about here. And it's
across
worth teasing
streams,
that out.
Man.
And it's
across
also, it's, I mean, there, that backlash may take place, but right now we're at historic highs in public polling in favor of school choice backpack funding. And there's been a host of bills introduced and passed in various states, which I think is also important to point out. Suderman, I'll give you semi-last word here about the Trumpness. I mean, there's a supercut from Youngkin of all the times that Terry McAuliffe has just sort of said it's about Trump, over and over again. Is there a... I don't know. It's not a statute of limitations, but like, is there a limit to the effectiveness of that strategy? And do you think people will learn from that, or are we still just going to be talking about Trump in every local whatever the hell election going forward?
I think there's some limitation to the effectiveness of that strategy at this particular moment, given just like obviously given that Terry McAuliffe is not doing well here. I mean, it's possible that he will still eke out a win, but he was supposed to win this in a cakewalk, and it's not obvious that he's going to. And instead, this race is largely being fought over the education policy or education adjacent issues, right? And so just, you know, to go back to what Nick said, I would just divide what parents are mad about from what Youngkin is actually saying and what Republicans are actually proposing. There are really huge problems with Republican messaging and legislation on education policy right now. The CRT bills are quite bad in many cases, although it is difficult to characterize them generally since the language varies from state to state. But Youngkin has sped ahead, has made himself a real contender in this race by capitalizing on deep frustration with the education system. Some of that coming out of COVID, right? A lot of that coming out of COVID, as Nick said. And just a lot of parents are really upset with the way that Democrats have worked in lockstep with teachers' unions and have promoted policies and agendas that are just totally in opposition to what parents want from their kids' schools. And that is what I think is powering Youngkin's surge to possible victory here, much more than Trump, than anything surrounding Trump specifically is.
I went as part of a piece I wrote on Friday, went and looked into the incidents that were listed in the now semi-notorious letter from the National School Board Association asking for special attention from the Justice Department to look into possible violence at school board meetings among the parents and going there. And you would think by judging the coverage that the parents were most exercised in these incidents about CRT or perceived CRT. The vast majority was about masking. The vast majority. Some of it was about masking at the meeting itself. Some of it was masking in schools. But that was animating the bulk of these things, which were also not violent. They were just disrupted public meetings. Catherine, I know I said I'd give Peter the last word on this, but I want to have one concept from you before we go to our email of the week, which is as follows. I don't think he's meek.
The meek shall inherit the earth.
J.D. Tuccilli has a aforementioned column from today, kind of echoing some of the stuff that Nick is saying, that this is verging on a failed opportunity to have a good policy discussion instead of a culture war. My question to you, Catherine, is in our, kind of low trust, negatively polarized world that we're living in, isn't every perceived large neutral organization a culture war that's just waiting to happen?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's what you just described is the best evidence for this. The fact that so many players in this discussion have accepted on both the right and the left that anger at a school board meeting about masking is somehow really the same thing as anger about CRT, which is somehow really the same thing as anger about a potential sexual assault in a bathroom by a person whose gender identity is somewhat unclear at this stage in the narrative. The fact that both sides are in some way accepting that those are all a tightly related cluster of issues shows how far we have gone down the kind of affective polarization road. And I think it fills me with despair. I'm generally a cheerful person and I'm optimistic about humans getting their shit together. But I think that the partisan polarization of institutions and topics that were previously not as polarized in this way, people were angry about individual issues, but the way that the clustering is functioning now is, genuinely causing me to feel despair. And I think it causes people to think less well about these topics, to think less clearly and less rationally, to be less open to new information. And it yields stuff like Youngkin's speech last week that I just pulled up, where he said, "We all know education starts with curriculum. We will teach all history, the good and the bad." And then 2 minutes later said, "Therefore, on day one, I will ban critical race theory in our schools." And the fact that anyone can hear that speech and be like, "Got it, nailed it, excellent work," just shows how far down the road we are to just red team, blue team, and not any kind of critical thinking about anything at all.
All right, we're going to get to our email of the week, meek, whatever, in a moment. But first, speaking of despair, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, and similar problems? You can do something about that today. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what the Braves need in their rotation, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her or Loki out. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right.
Do not get mental health, reminder, please, help from Loki. Don't do that.
I don't know. I don't know, man. I think he's got some insights. Please keep your hopefully brief emails coming to roundtable@reason.com. I emphasize the brevity here because Alex Bernardo did not do that. He came in at 1,150 words, which I'm absolutely not going to read. But I wanted to get into the nut of it, which is that basically Alex is super healthy. He's 32 years old. He's a non-unionized school teacher who loves Reason, like that. And he's unvaccinated by choice, because even though he has encouraged many of his older and less healthy friends and relatives to take it, he still has concerns about the potential adverse side effects of the vaccine and is waiting to see how the research develops over the next several months or years. He's also visiting nutritionists and doing so many things in order to avoid not getting a vaccine. So Alex's question or statement that he wants us to respond to is as follows. I just do not think that it is consistent with libertarian principles to support public or private sector vaccine mandates that don't provide a reasonable accommodation for those who have legitimate concerns. I also don't agree with Catherine Mangu Ward that those working in the public sector should be vaccinated without providing those reasonable accommodations and, if need be, still require masking. Catherine, you've been called out.
Hey, Alex. I'm sorry you don't agree with me. I think that what libertarianism can shed light on is the distinction that you kind of glossed over a little, which is the difference between a public sector mandate and a private sector mandate. And I think that, you know, we have talked in the past on this podcast about, you know, thin versus thick libertarianism. I'm delighted that mostly those terms are out of fashion just because, like, blech. But that a very, very
thick libertarianism always sounds like a kind of mucus.
Ugh, no, thank you. But basically, I think libertarianism has a lot to say about what the public sector can and cannot do. And I have been very clear that I oppose public sector vaccine mandates. I oppose the government mandating vaccines or forcing employers to mandate vaccines. So, you know, right there, I think, you know, it's important to restate that principle. I think that private employers absolutely have the right to do that and in some cases may have an obligation. What I think, though, your question is getting at is about the exceptions. And I will say, I think that libertarianism doesn't have a lot to say about whether exceptions should be offered, but morality does. That ethics does. And I think that it's the right thing to do to offer exceptions if you can and still safely function. You know, in the case of many workplaces, those exemptions are very easy to offer. You can work at home. Or there's testing and masking and all that. I think it's also fair for employers, though, to say we don't want those accommodations to extend to requiring everyone to mask because that interferes with our work. So we're drawing the line here, we're drawing the line there. If you work for one of these employers, I think, you know, you're perfectly welcome to quit your job if that configuration isn't working for you. And I recognize that for many people, that is an inadequate answer. But these are all going to be tough choices. They're all going
to
be...
Catherine, to be clear, I'm interrupting you, but I am. You said that you're against all public sector mandates.
Yes.
Am I hearing you correctly
yes.
on that? So, like, teachers, he's a
right.
teacher, and you're against the mandate that he should
be vaccinated. So the thing that we've talked about on this podcast before is that, you know, there's actually, it's a little unclear whether we're thinking of, for instance, employees of the government here as employees. So, you know, essentially, like, this is a proxy to private mandates, or whether we're thinking of this as a government mandate. I think there's some gray area there. Again, what I have said on this podcast in the past is that as far as public mandates go, I think that it is more justifiable to mandate that people who mandatorily interact with the public be vaccinated, far less justifiable some jerk in the transportation department who's just a desk jockey. So I think there are shades of gray here. I think it's tough, but all accommodations extract costs from other people, and private employers are in a good position to balance those, and the federal government with a giant cudgel is not.
Nick, you and I both live in New York City, where the government employee, of which there are, I think, 5 trillion government employees in New York City, that mandate, that deadline was Friday at 5 o'clock. There have been now the beginnings of layoffs or furloughs. I'm not exactly sure of the mechanism because of this. Mayor Bill de Blasio is crowing about the 91% vaccine compliance, which includes, hilariously, and always has, 100% from the Landmarks Preservation Committee and like 56% from the fire department, although I think that's a little bit higher now. Does it strike you as weird and like wrong that the sanitation department, which, you know, thankfully is having a slowdown, so the bags of trash on the sidewalk are just mountainous at this point. But like, the dudes are on trash trucks. Like, do they need a vaccine mandate? Do you find that weird, or do you like, hey, look, we can reduce the size of government this way, so screw them?
No, I'm not a fan of just saying for all the wrong reasons this worked out well, so let's make that policy. On the latter point, I think that's dangerous, because we need to be articulating what are the principles that we believe in, so that when things are unclear or the next time around, we actually are acting kind of intentionally. I think part of the problem here is that I could understand, or I can mandates. I could get behind certain types of public mandates, maybe not from the federal government. Vaccine mandates have traditionally been done at the state or more local level. But if there was smallpox, if we had a smallpox pandemic and 30% of the people who get infected die, I think there's an argument to be made for some kind of mandatory vaccination or quarantining. When we're talking about COVID, there is not. And particularly then when so employers, private employers, certainly probably public employers should have lots of free rein to dictate, make whatever demands they want of their workforce. I think it's very libertarian to critique them for that. And I think it's really stupid in the case of COVID, because COVID's infection fatality rate is so low. It's particularly the case with, in schools. If people are healthy, kids are not, contracting the disease or spreading the disease in any meaningful way. And here's the clincher for me, is that if you're vaccinated, you're essentially bulletproof. You have inoculated yourself against being hospitalized or dying from COVID. So it seems to me really bad to be pushing vaccine mandates on any substantial workforce at this point. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. If that infection fatality rate was much higher, that might be a different conversation to have and things like that. So that doesn't get to the larger kind of framework thing. But I think, from a libertarian point of view, we respect different people having different ideas and different values. Some people might, a company might say, hey, you can work here, but we want you to spend 2 days a week working for a nonprofit of your choice, but that's part of what you have to do if you want to work here. I would love to see a world in which that happens, and then to be able to either criticize or applaud that particular program. When it comes to this with vaccine mandates, I think the writer makes a really strong point. He is not concerned about it. He is not likely to be, a patient zero, killing tons of children or even his colleagues, especially if he's being tested. I don't see why he should be vaccinated.
Peter, how about that? That sense, you've stressed in the past that there's obviously decision rights with employers; they get to make that decision. But isn't it at this point kind of a bad decision? Like, even let's say that the trash was being done as it should be, as a private contracting thing per rules written by Bob Poole in New York City, which will never happen probably. But
we
let's
can
say that
dream.
Happens.
We can dream.
We can dream, and it should happen. But so that private employer says, you know what? The guy picking up the trash and fending off the rats and interacting with me, not at all, should be vaccinated or quit at a time when, I just got my booster shot on Saturday. I'm not going to get it at all. Like, who are we protecting? And isn't it the thing to do to say, hey, look, these are dumb ideas at this point, at the stage of the pandemic becoming endemic and the widespread availability of vaccines? Who are we protecting with these things?
I mean, I guess I just think that private employers have the right to set the terms on which they will hire and retain employees, and employees can decide if they want to comply. And that's true for vaccine mandates, and it's true for other policies, right? I mean, you can an employer might say, look, you've got to be on the road for 3 nights a week, and that's not going to work for everybody. Some people are going to say, hey, I don't want to do that. That is not convenient for my schedule. It might make, they might even have health reasons for something like that. They might say, well, look, my mental health is going to be a problem. It's going to disconnect me from my family, from things that make me happy. There might be very good reasons to then not want to take that job, but the employer might say that's going to be a condition. And employers can make these can make things conditions of employment, even in the middle of employment. They can change the terms, right? They can say, look, next year, we're going to require everybody to be on the road 3 nights a week, or we're going to require vaccination or whatever it is. And employers make so many of these decisions, some of which are more salutary than others. But like, I just don't feel like it's my place to kind of critique overall, you know, what employers are doing in terms of these decisions. But I actually want to address a different part of this question, which is just about the listener's point about being young and healthy. I think the age factor is much more important there. It really is true that COVID is, the people who are most susceptible to COVID are the elderly, 70, 80 years old in particular. But, you know, I am actually just sort of, I think the logic is somewhat flawed on this, because the listener is concerned about the relative newness of mRNA vaccines and the potential side effects. Now, if that's the concern, J&J isn't mRNA. It's a very old technology that's been tested for forever. But okay, it's true with any vaccine, anything that you put in your body, including, you know, Olive Garden spaghetti, you just don't know exactly what's going to happen 10 years down the road or even a couple of days from now. But if you're not getting vaccinated and you're not then also quarantining, you have basically agreed to get the virus at some point. No, you're not guaranteed to get it, but this is an endemic virus. It's going to be with us for years and possibly generations. You are quite likely to get COVID at some point if you are not vaccinated. And so probably if you are in your early 30s and relatively healthy, you're going to survive that. But you have to weigh the long-term risk of getting the virus as well. And while I think the jury is still out on things like long COVID, we certainly don't know what the long-term effects, what the lasting effects of the virus will be. And the virus, unlike the vaccine, is a bad thing that is attacking your body versus the mRNA vaccine, which is just designed to prime the body to resist the bad thing. So if you don't get vaccinated because you're worried about the long-term effects, the possible unknowns of mRNA technology, I think what you're kind of saying is you think the risk of getting a potentially deadly virus, and it is potentially deadly even to people who are in their early 30s, even if the risk is very low, you think those risks are actually lower than the long-term risks of the vaccine. And I think that that is not the right calculation to make.
So you're willing to judge the individual to make that calculation, but not the employer.
There is a question about, you know, when we talk about employment at a public versus a private setting. And traditionally, you know, private employers are given more latitude to dictate terms to their employees. So, for instance, private universities can tell people that they can't say certain things in a way that public universities, this is the distinction that FIRE is essentially based on. Public institutions have to abide by First Amendment, you know, certain types of freedom of expression. So if anything, there is a stronger case for saying that public employers have less latitude to demand things of their employees, which is also probably worth kind of factoring into this.
All right, let's factor in towards our end of show what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I have recommended this author's books before on this podcast, but I was having one of those moments where it feels like there's nothing to read. You know, sometimes you just have that like, oh no, I must have read all the books, darn. And when I have those moments, I go check if any of my favorite authors have written something new. And lo and behold, Naomi Novik has written, it looks like it will be a trilogy. The second one came out, I think, just last week, but I just read the first one. It's called A Deadly Education. It's basically her answer to Hogwarts, but that makes it sound dumb, and it's not dumb. So one thing I really like about Novik's writing is that she is a fantasy author who thinks a lot about, who seems to think a lot about economic concepts. So these books are based on the idea that there is essentially a sort of debt to be paid for any magic that you do. And that there's sort of a balance of good magic and bad magic in the world, and that the debt is actually quite significant. So it's just a very, very, very dark look at what it might be like to train magic doers. I don't think I'm giving anything away since we learned this in the very first pages of the book, but like the fatality rate is high at this quasi Hogwarts, and that already just takes it to like a much better level, because that's a huge problem with the Harry Potter books is like the constant mortal peril. And then it's like, one minor character died. We don't care. So I've read the first one and it's quite good. I will be reading the second one. But if you liked Harry Potter, but maybe want something a little darker and more economically literate, check out Naomi Novik's new trilogy.
Boom. Suderman, what have you been doing?
I have been listening to the new album by The War on Drugs, which in this case, and only this case, is great. Love The War on Drugs.
We're going to pull out that clip and run it in our campaign ads against you later.
Yeah, I know. So it's called I Don't Live Here Anymore, and it is a great modern classic rock album. This is an album that like really calls to mind Bruce Springsteen and also early 80s Phil Collins Genesis, but in the best possible way without just feeling like a retread or a ripoff. It's epic and sort of soaring and like deeply personal while also not feeling like just sort of sad, mopey indie rock. It's just a great actual rock album in an era where rock sort of feels like it's kind of dead and dying and there isn't anybody doing anything new anymore. And this feels new and alive while also hearkening back to the classics in a way that is just extremely rare and extremely satisfying.
You've just almost sold me. The classic rock is great element,
I would,
but then
especially,
the like early 80s Genesis Bruce Springsteen's kind of going to be hard.
I would recommend tracks 4 and 5, and in particular track 5, Victim, which just is big and anthemic, and also, you know, it just works so well. It has such a great hook that doesn't also feel like, oh, this is just sort of designed to be catchy radio pop at all.
Nick, what have you been doing?
I have been listening to back episodes of the Psychoactive podcast, which is hosted on iHeartMedia or iHeartRadio, iHeart.com, I guess it is now, by Ethan Nadelman, who is the former, he's the founder and former head of the Drug Policy Alliance, and now he is this podcaster. Where he talks about all aspects of drugs, about drug policy, drug war, criminal justice reform, post-prohibitionist drug culture, things like that. His most recent episode is with Carl Hart, the Columbia neuroscientist, whose book last year, Drug Use for Grownups, is a fantastic, very libertarian attack on the drug war as being bad because it strips us of our God-given autonomy and ability to change our minds according to how we see fit. That episode is fantastic. It's the most recent one, and I highly recommend listening to that. And it gets to why Ethan Nadelman knows everything there is to know about drug policy. He was a former political science professor at Princeton before he got into drug policy work. He knows about how drugs work. He knows about how people are afraid of drugs. And in this particular episode, he and Carl talk about two things that are particularly interesting. One is a recent wave of what they call psychedelic exceptionalism, which is a problem in a lot of drug policy circles where people will say, you know, my drug, and this happened at High Times, used to do this in the 70s, where they say, you know, weed is great because weed is natural and normal and good. But cocaine or, you know, angel dust, these are bad drugs. They're synthesized. They're corporate. They're in a lab. There's a version of that with psychedelics that's going on now that threatens to kind of split and derail a anti-prohibitionist movement, which is really, winning the war on drugs. And then the other thing they talk about, which was just fascinating, was what Ethan called drugism. And it's kind of like racism, but against people who use drugs other than basically weed and alcohol and maybe tobacco, although tobacco people get demonized all the time. And it's just, it's an incredible, if you want to know where the culture is going vis-a-vis intoxicants and all of the good and bad things that can come out of that, listen to Ethan Nadelman's Psychoactive podcast. He happens to be the last episode of my own podcast, The Reason Interview. And it's a great conversation there. But he, you know, many of the people that he's talked to recently, he talked to a guy named Elias Dockwar about ketamine, which is being used for all kinds of medicinal as well as recreational purposes. Julie Holland, who's one of the leading researchers on how drugs get used. She's also a psychotherapist. Leonard Picard, who was he basically took over making all the LSD at a certain point and spent time in jail, in federal prison for that. He talked to Chuck Schumer, who used to be a drug warrior and is now trying to legalize marijuana in a pretty profound way. It's the Psychoactive podcast is just, it's a great listen. And Ethan is a great raconteur and host who doesn't let anybody off easy. When he's had on people who want to blame the opioid crisis merely on the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, and he complicates that. He doesn't let anyone off the hook for anything, but he's not a bullshit artist. So it's Psychoactive. It's a great podcast.
I hope he talked Chuck Schumer out of prosecuting breakfast cereal makers.
Yeah, no, that, you know, well, come on, you know, you can't win them all, Matt.
Can't win them all. Mine is, as I mentioned before, I went to an adult costume party, and there was this dude who looked like he was dressed up like one of the members of the Misfits, the punk rock kind of horror punk band. And he walked up to me and a huge fan of Reason, and he's actually a member of the Misfits, punk rock band, Jerry Only, his name is, a very well-preserved 62-year-old, kind of aspirational there. Kat Timpf, who was throwing the party, is a longtime fan of the Misfits and has been seeing their shows forever. And as is our own Damon Root, Misfits, very important. So I, one has gaps in one's musical knowledge. I had literally never heard a single song by the Misfits that, as far as I knew. So I, as we were preparing the front yard for Halloween and sweeping up all the leaves, brought my little speaker out and just did the shuffle songs by the Misfits thing really loud. Perfect Halloween punk rock music.
They're made for this. It's like, every day is Halloween with the Misfits.
It's amazing. So I'm still at the shuffle songs by phase. If anyone has some recommendations for particular records that they love, I know Damon is going to get back to me pretty soon on that. Please send them to me. But if you like just like short, aggressive, funny, punk rock, schlock punk, not schlock, shock punk rock, it's great. Enjoy the hell out of it. Nick, if you want to give one recommendation to a Misfit song, this is your opportunity. Otherwise, keep your peace.
I'll just say, start with Walk Among Us. Wonderful album.
Very, very good. Very good. Thank you, Nick. And thank you to everybody listening to the Reason Roundtable podcast, your Monday podcast. Our organization's podcasts live at reason.com/podcasts. Including the recent interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum, whose impresario is Gene Epstein. We will catch you next Monday. Goodbye. Thank you.